This episode is brought to you by the Women's Network.
I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, the minute I no longer like the person I see, that will be the time that I pack up my bags and I go back home. And thank God I never did that. So sometimes that means going against the grain. Sometimes that means standing by yourself, standing alone for what you believe in. Never compromise yourself. But always make sure that your reputation and that you're networking and that you're just honest and earnest all the time. And people will respect that and people will think of you.
And welcome back to another episode of Redefining Ambition. I'm your co-host, Jamie Vinnick, founder and president of the Women's Network. And for this next episode, I will be co-hosting with none other than Jaren Valdry, our former TWN University of Southern California chapter president, who has held many internships in the music industry and is currently interning as an A&R intern at RCA Records. I am so excited to introduce our next guest. Monty Duncan is a veteran marketer and brand strategist who is now at the helm of BBH New York, a creative agency where she serves as president, overseeing day-to-day activities while also managing high-level strategy and direction for the agency's clients, including Samsung. Before joining BBH New York, Duncan served as MTV Senior Vice President of Music, Head of Brand Marketing at Martin Guitar, the acoustic guitar manufacturer founded nearly 200 years ago, and Chief Marketing Officer of Sean Combs' Bad Boy Worldwide Entertainment Group. Duncan has also held senior positions at Capitol Music Group, where she served as SVP of Marketing, and Virgin Records, where she served as VP of Production and Promotion. So essentially, she's done it all, and we're so honored to have you on the podcast. Welcome, Imani.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that amazing introduction. It's so funny when you hear someone recite back like your career trajectory. You're just like, oh God, really? I did all that? But I'm so happy to be here with you all.
So happy you're here. So we'll get right into a career trajectory. I love to understand what inspired someone to develop different interests and passions. Can you describe what your upbringing was like and any early influences or inspirations that shaped who you are?
Oh, absolutely. I had a charmed childhood. I was really, really lucky and fortunate to have two parents that were conscious and active and believed in giving. So my sister and I have one older sister. She's a year and a half older than me. So we were basically like twins. And they instilled in us the giving spirit. We grew up quite privileged. And because both my parents were very conscious, they instilled in us and would say constantly from my earliest memory that because of the way that we grew up, we had a responsibility. And that responsibility was to pay it forward and give back also to those who were less fortunate. It was an incredible household to be in. I would come home from school and there may be like a homeless family living with us for a period of time as my parents worked to help them get back on their feet. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm a West Coast person, born and raised. We lived in the Bay Area, lived in South Pasadena, and then moved to LA proper when I was in the third grade. And, you know, our time in the Bay Area was amazing. It was in Oakland. I still love Oakland to this day. And if I had to move back to the West Coast, I would definitely move to the Bay Area. But when we lived in South Pasadena, I was in kindergarten up until the third grade. At that time, we were the only Black family in South Pasadena. And we didn't know that. At least my mom didn't know that. And I don't even know if my dad knew that. We moved there because my dad took a job at Aramco as an electrical engineer. And South Pasadena is pretty much the one percenters that live out there. And my mom told us the story of, you know, my sister and I obviously were just little bitty things. When they were settling into the house, my dad went to work. My mom was like tooling around town, going to like the dry cleaner and the bank. And she said every place she went to, she didn't see any people of color. And she thought, okay, well, maybe, I don't think she knew what to think, to be honest. And she came home and she addressed it with my dad and was like, where did we just move to? You know, there's not, like, I've been all over town. There's not one person of color. And obviously my parents are from a different generation. So the impact was something profound, I could imagine. But for us kids, it didn't matter. We were ingratiated into the town. We went to school. We were the only two people of color at our elementary school, but we weren't treated differently at all. I didn't experience racism to my memory, neither did my mom or my dad. Both my sister and I had tons of friends in the community. They lived in, you know, big houses, but so did we. So I didn't really feel there was any difference. And I didn't identify people as color. And it wasn't until we moved to LA proper that the racism started. And it was jarring. It was really, really hard. Like, for example, my third grade teacher, I went to Third Street Elementary School, which is located in the Hancock Park area of Los Angeles. And we were not the only people, kids of color, but the kids who did go there, the small population of Black kids that went there, were very similar to my sister and I, as far as upbringing and socioeconomic background. And I remember going into the class, it was my third grade teacher, her name was Mrs. Wilson. And I could see her to this day in my mind's eye. She was just this tall, beautiful Black woman. And I was just enraptured by her. I was like, oh my gosh, she's just Beyonce. She's magical. I don't know. And, you know, I remember my mom picking us up from school and I was just over the moon. I'm just babbling. You know, I was in the third grade. I was just like, oh my God, I was just so excited. And I kept talking about Mrs. Wilson. And my mom graduated, she had her master's in early childhood education. And she knew what I was trying to say, but she was like probing me. And I was just talking about her and I was talking everything about her. I was being very descriptive about how she looked to me and the impact she had on me. But I never said she was Black. And my mom kept probing me and probing me. And I finally just got so frustrated and bored with the conversation as a third grader. And I pointed to my hand and I said, she looks just like me. So calling someone Black was not, or calling someone white simply wasn't part of my vocabulary. You were a girl or you were a boy or you had yellow hair or you had Black hair or brown hair. Like, that's how I described people. So my mom was like, oh my gosh, you know, she said later on, and she told us that once I described that, you know, by pointing to my hand and saying she looks like me, she knew she made the right decision to move the family, force my father to move the family back to LA proper, because he was fine in South Pasadena. I mean, it was lovely. You know, we had a beautiful home there and life there, but it was the best decision. But it was painful because most of the bullying came from people that looked like me, that were Black people. And I just couldn't understand that. I was so happy just to be around Black kids, you know what I mean, that looked like me, but they wanted nothing to do with me because I spoke differently. They just felt like I was this odd personality. You know, children could be so cruel and unforgiving. So what it did do is it taught my sister and I resilience. It taught us how to move within different socioeconomic groups with ease, which always afforded me well as I graduated and moved into the corporate world. You know, I always say I can go from the boardroom to the club with ease. so it did teach us life skills and how to apply them and how to navigate rooms, but also give us the confidence to walk into rooms where we are the only one and not feel anything about that either and still feel we have a place in the world. So we were in an environment as children, even growing up to being teenagers and young adults, feeling like we were invincible, feeling like there wasn't anything that could stop us. We could achieve and imagine greatness. And my dad was really instrumental in our lives and making sure we understood that we are worthy and that we are meant to be treated in a certain way. So that was, I feel very blessed and proud to have come from two really strong, determined, educated parents that taught my sister and I how to soar.
Wow. I mean, what an anecdote. I feel like I identify so well with that story as well growing up.
Yes.
Where I did. I grew up in the South and I feel like I had a very similar upbringing to yours. And so kind of on the topic of education and becoming a young adult, you know, you studied at Cal State Northridge and you earned a degree in political science and government, but then you pivoted and moved away from law school and ended up taking an unpaid internship at Def Jam Records. Can you talk a little bit about what inspired you to pivot? And from there, you know, what are some of the skills that you were able to learn and then apply to later paid internships and moving into your career in the music industry?
Absolutely. Great question. You know, for as long as I could remember, I was always told that I should be a lawyer. And being that, you know, my sister was more of a gypsy and free-spirited artist, and she would walk into rooms, you know, making these grand statements of, I'm going to Kenya for 3 months to build wells for clean water, and then she'd just be gone. But me, I was more of the academic and type A personality, and I envied her free spirit, but it just, I needed things to be way buttoned up and I needed to work in a methodical way. So for as long as I can remember, I was told by my parents and their friends that I should be an attorney. And so therefore I thought I should be an attorney. And I did everything I was supposed to do. I, you know, went to graduated well from high school, went to university. Wasn't my first choice, but I had a bit of a crisis. My parents announced in my senior year that they were separating, they were divorcing, and I did not see that coming. And so I really shut down. I didn't apply to anything. Yeah. So, you know, one of those tragic stories. So I went to Northridge and I was glad I did because I had a great experience at Cal State. And I was a political science major, minored in international relations, was determined to go to law school and then work abroad and become a UN ambassador. That was really my trajectory. We started traveling to Europe at the age of 12 because my father took a job with Aramco Saudi and moved to Saudi Arabia for about 8 years. And we didn't go. My mom didn't want to raise two young girls in the Middle East. But as a compromise, we would, instead of him traveling all the way back to the States, where he was just like catatonic, basically, when he would get home, because it was just, you're going through so many different time zones. It's such a long and arduous flight. We would meet him in Europe. So we would spend summer vacations in all over Europe. And I just fell in love, you know, I just fell in love with Europe. And I thought I would always just work abroad. So I did all of that, graduated, got into law school, and literally had a meltdown. I think it was the first time, you know, going through the process of entering law school and, you know, realizing that, you know, the investment and everything, you know, it's very sobering. You have to really, really be ready. And I wasn't. I questioned for the very first time whether or not this was actually my goal or just what I had been told for so long that I had just adopted it as mine. And it was really scary and frightening. And I didn't know what to do. I never allowed myself to have an alternative thought. I was so single-minded, focused, blinders on, you know, so to be in a, you know, early 20s and faced with what am I going to do? I have this degree in political science. I don't want to teach. So what do I do with this? So it was a really rough time for myself. My parents did not help either. A lot of pressure, but I got them to agree to let me just defer. Like I just needed a moment to just catch my breath and recalibrate. And my mom's like, you're never going to go back if you do this. And she's right. I never went. But, you know, I would be sitting on my parents' couch, my mom's couch. My dad was living in the Bay Area, just feeling sorry for myself. Just like, you know, my dad cut me off on my allowance. I'm mad at him. Like I'm just picking fights with everyone for no real reason. Because I'm so lost and I'm so angry. And, you know, and I played piano since the age of 5. And there was always music in my house. My dad played every instrument. My sister played violin. My mom played guitar and I played piano. And I went to bed one night and I woke up and I was like, I got it. I like music, so I'm going to work in the music industry. I mean, when I think back on that now, it just sounds so utterly ridiculous. Like, the only through line was that I played piano, okay? And I played classical music. And here I am thinking, I'm just going to work in the music business. I didn't even know what that meant. But I picked up the Yellow Pages and I flipped to record company, literally, no lie. And the first company I saw was Def Jam. And I was like, do I even know their music? I was like, Def Jam? Okay, sure. And I picked up the phone and I called. And just so happened, the head of A&R, which is Artists and Repertoire, they're the people who actually sign and find the artists, picked up the phone. And I went into my little speech. I'm a recent college grad and I'm looking for an internship and blah, 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 blah. And she said, just show up tomorrow, and hung up. I was like, okay. Do I have a job? And I told my parents, I have a job. I'm going to work in the music business for this company called Def Jam. My mom starts crying. She's like, oh my God, we need therapy. She's lost her mind. We need an intervention. My dad's like, oh gosh, what is happening? So I showed up the next day and they put me to work. They said they cannot pay me. I told my parents it was a paying job. And I just became a student all over again. And I absorbed everything I possibly could. It was a small office in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard. It had 5 people in there. And I was working for the head of A&R. And it was just a crash course. I was filling out publishing contracts and transcribing lyrics with hip hop. I'm like, I never listened to hip hop. What is happening? But it was fun. It was fun. And, you know, there was very little rules. And I was just kind of making things up as I went along, coming to the end of the 3 months and an internship. And I was like, I got to get a job. Like, I can't fake this anymore. And I think I want to stay in this a little bit longer. So I basically, you know, read every paper that came across, copied my boss's Rolodex, acted like I was a staff person. And I remember one story of me going to drop off tapes to this gentleman called John Platt. They call him John, Big John Platt. And he is now the chairman of Sony ATV. And we're still friends to this day. And I remember going to him and dropping off a demo tape for Tina Davis, who was the head of A&R, who I was working with, who went on to manage Chris Brown and all these wonderful people. And I said, you know, John, because I had been going to him back and forth and we started a friendship. And I said, I need a job. And he goes, what do you mean you have a job? And I was like, no, I don't. He's like, what are you talking about? You work for Def Jam. I was like, no, I don't. I'm an unpaid intern. He's like, shut up. He's like, no, you're not. He goes, I would have never thought that. And that was a great life lesson of like, if you want to be a president, act like a president. If you want to be a VP, act like a VP. And long story short, they ended up finding money for me. And I took the job as an office manager of 5 people who were never in the office. But I didn't care. You know, I wanted to get in. I found a way in. And I knew that once I got in, I would do what I needed to do. And I proceeded to create my own job, which unbeknownst to me was the promotions manager. And I got on the radar of the execs in New York. And I called my old boss, Kevin Lyles, every single day. He's now the co-founder of and CEO of 300 Entertainment. And I bugged him every single day and said, move me to New York. I need to be where the action's at. Didn't even know what that meant. But I was like, I need to be in New York. I don't need to be in this little satellite office, blah, 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 blah. But the work I was doing, my made up job, started catching attention in the New York office. And so one day he called me on a Friday and said, okay, are you ready? I'm like, ready for what? I completely forgot. And he goes, I'm moving you to New York. You need to be on the red eye flight Sunday. And the rest is history.
Wow. I mean, it's funny because I come from a classical background as well. Yeah. And so now moving into the industry, I'm moving into A&R.
Okay.
And, you know, our trajectories have been very, very similar from the beginning, which is so interesting. And I'm curious to know, networking is such a huge part of the industry. And, you know, as you were in that internship, you were meeting John Platt, and then later you met Kevin Lyles, who are now, you know, 2 of the biggest heads in the industry. And I'm curious to know, you know, how did you learn those networking skills? And then how did you become confident in those? Because that's really how you're able to, you know, create a space for yourself in this industry. That's really, as much as it is business, it is also very social at the same time.
It is. You know, I, unlike a lot of my colleagues that I had worked with throughout the years, they always wanted to be in the music industry. Just like I always thought I was going to be a lawyer. So, you know, for me, it wasn't because I didn't have that, oh, I have to be in the music industry. I viewed it very differently. I viewed it as a business. So I really leaned into the business side of it. I wanted to understand P&Ls. I wanted to understand how a record company operated. But as far as networking, and so part of networking, I wanted to build a reputation in the business as being an astute businesswoman. And I knew it needed to start from day one. Now, a lot of the confidence I had was simply because of my upbringing. Again, I was taught that I could fly and that there was really nothing I couldn't do if I committed to it. But the other part of it was knowing that you only have one shot to impress. And you have to be about something, you know. People don't realize that the minute you get your job, actually the minute you're in the interview, you're building your reputation that will follow. Every industry, I don't care which one it is, I've been in so many, they're all small and everyone knows everyone. So, and I say that to say you're not going to, everyone's not going to love you. Okay. But that shouldn't matter. Kevin Lyles told me one time when I moved to New York, I mean, here's this LA girl, you know, going into like core hip hop during the 90s at Def Jam, the premier hip hop label. And here I am like, hi, let's go do yoga. They were like, get out of here. Is this kook, you know? And it was hazing, you know? And I remember going to Kevin crying, you know, I'm so young. And I was like, they hate me. They're talking about me. And he goes, who cares? Who cares? He goes, you need to be so focused on making sure that you are the very best at your job. Because people can't hate on success. They can try. They just sound stupid. That's like you talking about Jay-Z. Jay-Z could care less that you're talking about him. Drake could care less that you're talking about them. They're success, you know? So I was like, that's right. That's the best piece of advice. So I just made sure that my reputation was clean and that every time someone had an encounter with me, it was memorable. What matters in business and any industry you're in is what people say about you when you're not in the room. So my recommendation is make sure you're making the very best impression. I don't care if it's to the people who clean the office, to the president of the office, because you never know who someone is. The person that you're looking at that's in jeans and a t-shirt could be the owner of the company. Always make sure you have respect for people, that you treat people with dignity and grace, and that you set out early. What are my guidelines? I remember when I moved to New York and I was living in a hotel for 3 months and it was tough. I didn't know anyone. The only person I knew was Kevin. It was kind of like sink or swim. And I saw things that I did not like. I saw things that were foreign to me. And I remember coming home, I'll never forget this moment. And I looked at myself, I was really thinking about going back home. Like this isn't for me. This goes against everything I believe in. These people are like cruel and mean and not right or just. But I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, the minute I no longer like the person I see, that will be the time that I pack up my bags and I go back home. And thank God I never did that. Yeah. So sometimes that means going against the grain. Sometimes that means standing by yourself, standing alone for what you believe in. Never compromise yourself, but always make sure that your reputation and that you're networking and that you're just honest and earnest all the time. And people will respect that and people will think of you. When I left the industry, I walked away. I was like, I'm done. And I went into lots of other industries. And then when I was heading up marketing at Martin Guitar, which no one understood why I went there, but it was such a great job. There was a role that was needed at MTV for the head of music. Now, mind you, I hadn't talked to any of these people. They used to be my clients. I used to be at their homes and at parties together. I haven't spoken to these people in probably 8 years. But when the role came up, who did they call? Me. Now, they could have called all the other industry people that were still around, that were still in the mix, that they saw every day. But they called the person that they hadn't spoken to in 8 years. And we picked up like we never left. So that's what building a good relationship will afford you. People will think of you and speak highly of you when you're not in the room. So get on LinkedIn. I was on LinkedIn for so long. The minute I got a job, I got on LinkedIn. Start building those networks. Start building those relationships. You see someone in the hall, speak to them. I mean, I was an office manager calling the EVP of promotions at Def Jam Records. Fortune favors the bold. You have to become discoverable. And no one's going to give you anything. I'm sorry. No one's benevolent in business. So how are you going to cut through the fat? How are you going to leave an indelible mark on someone? You got to figure that stuff out early. So maybe it means you're the first one in the office and the last one to leave. Maybe it's you that's raising your hand every time there's an opportunity to lean in. How are you going to cut through the fat? Because it's noisy out there. There's a lot of people vying for those one or two positions. So how are you going to make sure that you get the interview? It's all about your reputation. It's about how you carry yourself. It's about how you present yourself. And it's about how you showed up. It's memorable. People do not forget. The one thing people will do is they will forget the good moments, but they will hold on to those missteps forever. So how do you handle when you misstep something? Do you pretend it didn't happen? Are you blaming the next person, or are you showing up with integrity and saying, you know what? I did misstep and this is what I learned from it. And trust me, it will never happen again. I'm going to remember the person who said that to me.
I have chills. So powerful. Yeah. And you're
thank you.
That is spot on.
Thank you.
My mom would always tell me that it's not enough to have a smooth interview. She would always ask the receptionist how she was treated by the interviewee. And it was shocking at how many people were disqualified because of that. You mentioned that people were questioning your decision to when you took a job as head of marketing. How do you decipher between really good advice and those who don't have your best intentions at heart or do and still give faulty advice? Where do you look for advice?
You have to create your circle. You know, when I was starting out, my circle was really my dad. You know, I would consult him. And then it became my dad and Kevin. I am not the one to seek advice from a lot of people. I'm just not one to do that. Because a lot of times when you are trying to make a decision and you're a bit confused or uncertain, the noise, all the different voices can just compound the stress and the anxiety around making a decision. Find those trusted advisors and they will come in and out. You will learn like that's more of a friend. I'm not going to get career advice from this person, or this person, it may not be what I want to hear, but this person is really giving me sound advice. So you start developing who that circle is. My advice is to keep that circle really small, really small. One example was when I was at a point, and you will have these certain points throughout your career where you need to make a hard decision. And so I was at a point in my career, I was at Def Jam. We had merged with Island. We became Island Def Jam, broke barriers, was one of three Black people in the industry at the time to do the entire roster for a major record label. That meant I wasn't just doing urban, I was doing pop, rock, country, as well as urban. And that was really based on an economic decision because no one could justify to me why I was making less money than my counterpart when I had 10 times the size of the roster. So I was like, yep, not doing that. So it got to a point where at Def Jam, Island Def Jam, I was a senior director of video promotions, killing it. You know, I had Jay-Z, I had DMX, I had everyone, Melissa Etheridge, I had Bon Jovi, I had everyone. And I said, you know, it's time. I went into my boss's office. You know, I went into Kevin and at the time, Julie Greenwald, who's the chairwoman of Atlantic Records, and Lior Cohen, He's head of music at YouTube Music. And so I marked myself into their office and I said, I deserve to be a vice president. And I gave them all the reasons why. And they said no. And I was like, disappointed. But at that moment, I realized it was time to move forward. Honestly, Def Jam is like the mob. No one leaves. Not the core team, the ones that were at 160 Barrack Street in New York that in the early 90s. We were like a family. We were a tribe. No one leaves. But I was like, I need to leave. And the reason why I needed to leave was it was very clear to me that just like a family member, because we were family, they just continued to see me, no matter how successful I was for the company, as that intern back in LA. And what a big decision to make, because again, no one leaves the family. And so I got a job offer to go to Virgin Records to be part of a turnaround. Virgin Records, illustrious label, but really just had fallen onto hard times, couldn't get a success. So they basically cleared house and brought in a new team of heavy hitters to turn this iconic label around. But keep in mind, I'm going from Def Jam. I never made an outbound phone call to Virgin Records starting at ground zero. What a decision. So it's like going from the majors to a AAA baseball team. I consulted only one person, and that person was Tom Calderon. And at the time, Tom was the president of MTV. And I called him and I said, Tom, I told him the situation. And he goes, you have to go. He didn't even hesitate. And I said, well, why? He goes, because you're at a point in your career that you need to know, are you good or are you good because of the label? I mean, because mind you, I didn't make one outbound call at Def Jam. The phone just rang. We need Jay for this. We need Jay for that. We need DMX for this. We need Ja Rule and Ashanti. We need Melissa Etheridge. We need Bon Jovi. I made not one outbound call. And I was like, oh God, you're so right. So talk about the trusted advisors. I made a strategic decision to consult one person that I trusted, because I knew that if I consulted everyone else, they would have been like, what are you talking about? Why would you leave the majors to go literally to a AAA team? Are you insane? You're in the sweet spot, blah, blah, blah. I didn't want to be told the obvious. I wanted someone to tell me something different. So long story short, I went and the phone did not ring, but I got everything done. And that was based on your relationships, your reputation. People wanted me to win, because I was just a nice person. I didn't lie to you. If I needed a favor, I told you, like, I really need this, guys. And I did that so seldom that when I did say, I really need this to happen, people were like, of course. I didn't lie to people. I was like, this is a piece of crap. You know, this is not good. I took the shots. You know, I didn't pass the buck. Whereas other label people were like, begging and pleading and like sob stories and then being mad at them if they didn't get what they want. I didn't play that game. I was like, it's not that deep. I respect you for what you are doing. You have a job to do, just like I have a job to do. So because of the relationship that I built over time, people wanted me to win. So they gave me everything I needed. And people were scratching their head like, I don't understand. Like, how is she getting these things done? They're ice cold. And that's when I realized, I'm actually good. It's not the label. Over time, just like your friend circle will shrink, your confidants and the people that you really go to in a clutch, that will be fine-tuned as well. And then at the end of the day, you might just be in a situation where you have to follow your gut. I've trained myself to listen really closely to my inner voice. You know when something's not right. You just know. And when you don't listen to that voice, it will always be a mistake. I humbly did that when I was leaving EMI, senior vice president of marketing for the pop rock side. And it was just time to go. I no longer believed in music. I didn't know what anyone was doing anymore. It was at the recession of 2008 and jobs were being lost. People were losing their homes. It was really scary times. And I left EMI with a beautiful package. I didn't have to work for 2 years, but I panicked. And I took a job. I took the CMO job with Sean. And even though my inner voice was screaming not to do it, I did it. I didn't listen. And while the job was amazing, it came at a price. And after that experience, I vowed to myself, I will never not listen to my inner spirit, my inner voice. So maybe I had to go through that to realize that it's simply not worth it. So my rules are never not listen to my inner spirit and never chase money. It's a fool's game. Don't do it. I'd rather stay and make a lateral move than to go take a new job with the fancy pants title and the big salary and hate every freaking second of it.
Thank you for sharing that. I wanted to ask you, it sounds like throughout your career and really life, you're someone who has stayed true to yourself. You are very authentic. You keep it real. I love how you mentioned your parents divorced. My parents divorced, and it was so taboo in the area I grew up in. Those who did come from families with divorced parents rarely spoke about it. And I was so embarrassed for a long period of time to come to terms with that until I got to college and realized I need to be my most authentic self. And everything you said, there will always be people who don't love me, and that's okay.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'm not going to people please my way to try to get everyone to like me. I don't care. And those who I like typically like me back.
Exactly. Yeah.
Funny how that works.
That's all you need. Yeah.
But I love the point you were making. I would love for you to elaborate that, you know, staying true to your most authentic self, not compromising your sense of self. And every industry, of course, has a different culture. You've worked in different industries. Finance attracts a different type of person than, say, the music industry. How are you able to work your way through different social scenes while staying true to who you are, not compromising your sense of self?
It's tough when you're first starting out, where you're really, you know, so singular focused and climbing that ladder and wanting to impress and afraid to make mistakes and all of those things. That's fully natural. You're not going to really live your authentic life in the way that you want to until there's a little bit of age behind you. Early in my career, I was just trying to just pay the rent. You know, I mean, honestly, eating $1 pizza slices in New York, we were all just like trying to just make it, but it was exciting. It was exhilarating. You know, working in the entertainment industry at that young age, I mean, I saw my friends getting caught up in the lifestyle of the rich and famous. And you really have to be diligent to not do that, to not get romance. They pay a dear price for that. You know, their reputations, their credibility, it's just not worth it. You know, I used to find little techniques to get myself out of compromising situations. You know, there's always the witching hour. And at every event, you know when that witching hour is about to start, and it's up to you to decide, how do I gracefully get out of this, or do I stay and deal with it? You know, a lot of industries, you have to balance the work and the social. And especially for young women, I say this all the time, you can never let your guard down. Never. Have one drink. Sure. Switch to club soda after that. You know, don't be that person. Because you'll never recover from it. I don't care what industry, you'll never recover from it. And is there still a double standard? Sure. Sure. Of course there is. Men still can do things that women will be vilified for. It doesn't matter. You know, we're not gonna constantly change that. But we can still be our authentic self with it. I think it comes down to, for me at least, I just cared more about myself. I know that sounds really egotistical, but it's not. I just cared more about my well-being and my happiness than being accepted. If someone didn't like it, that was their issue, not mine. And I don't know if it's because, you know, you're being a woman of color, entering into environments where I'm the only one. If you have a problem with me and I haven't offended you, I haven't done anything wrong to you, I'm not going to transfer that onto myself. That is solely your issue, and you're going to need to deal with it or not deal with it. But I'm going to keep moving forward. It takes a thick skin. You know, I think women in general, we're really not welcomed. They really don't want us there. So you're constantly figuring out ways to make sure your presence isn't overshadowed. Your voice isn't diminished. You're dealing with subconscious biases. Okay, so I'm bossy, but my male counterpart's considered a boss, or sitting in a room and explaining something very intelligently and then having the man say exactly verbatim what you just said, and he's a wizard.
Right.
So how do you deal with something like that? How how do you make sure that if someone said something that wasn't pleasant and maybe derogatory or degrading to something that you may have said, how do you respond so that that's not the last word? I used to say this to myself all the time. You have to know your threshold and you have to identify that really early on. How far is too far? Because if you don't identify what that is, you're going to go too far. So like I looked at myself in the mirror when I came to New York and said, if I don't like the person that I see back at me, then it's time for me to go. That was me drawing the line in the sand. That was me identifying my threshold of pain. Like, where is that line? Where is that line? That line's going to change as you mature in your career, but you got to start somewhere. Because if you don't know where that line is, it's going to be a hard road for you. And you might find yourself in some situations that you never imagined. And then you got to keep yourself honest with it. You know, you got to check yourself. Am I still living by my guiding principles? Did I go too far? There was times where I was so driven and I was so focused. I had no personal life. I was working around the clock and I was turning into this monster. And I was like, who am I? I don't even like the person that I am. I don't think I would have even recognized that if I wasn't doing the check-ins with myself to make sure that I wasn't going too far. And thank God I did a check-in. I did go too far. You know, I was living an inauthentic life. I was so focused on getting success and achieving these things that I was losing my sense of self. And I had to recalibrate. And I did that a couple of times throughout my career. So where is that tipping point for you? Like, where is it? Where is that line? Make it clear and then commit to constantly checking in on yourself so that you don't cross those weird lines because they can get blurred real fast.
Yes, most definitely. I mean, thank you so much for kind of going into depth on that. Really quickly, before we head into our lightning round of questions, I'm curious to know, so you're hired as the president of PBH, an advertising company that works with Black sheep thinkers and makers. And so can you just tell us a little bit about what makes someone a Black sheep thinker? And do you find that your career success stories come from being a Black sheep thinker?
Oh, absolutely. Great question. First of all, BBH is amazing. It's so funny how staying open to possibilities, I had no intention of going into the advertising world. I was always a client. I was the one that hired advertisers. But when I left Viacom, CBS in May, I was taking a much needed break to kind of figure out what that next chapter was going to be. And honestly, I was well progressed in conversations with Netflix. I was going to move back home to Los Angeles, take a role there when BBH called. And I was like, wow, what an illustrious agency. I mean, this is an agency that created Johnny Walker Keep Walking, that launched Levi's black denim jeans when that was a thing. Iconic, iconic, timeless work. But then to know that they were black sheep, that they were outliers when the world zigs, we zag. I was like, could this really be true? Because I've always been an outlier. I'm a huge fan of Simon Sinek and Malcolm Gladwell. Simon Sinek, everything starts with why. And of course, Malcolm with the outliers, because outliers are a combination of a lot of things. It's timing, it's luck, it's training. Where's your 10,000 hours? I've always grew up knowing that I could soar, knowing that anything is possible if you set your mind to it, and also being super fearless. And so going into different industries that I had no prior experience in, that's an outlier. That's a black sheep. And then having success there when everyone's telling me that, oh, you don't understand our industry. I'm like, oh, God. Business is business is business is business at the end of the day. I don't care what industry you're in. What you need to learn are the nuances of the industry. Okay. And that takes a high level of emotional intelligence that you should be culling and perfecting during your growth trajectory. That's what was so attractive to me, to be able to walk into an industry that was so diverse poor. Far as I know, I'm the only Black woman to be the president of a global advertising creative agency, to break through those doors again and be the first and then open more doors for people of color, because we need diverse thinking and we need diverse perspectives. And I wanted the agency to look and be representative of New York City in all of its glory. But yes, that thinking and that mindset of why not? Why not go into manufacturing? I've never managed blue collar workers. I mean, I don't know anyone that has my background, but why not? and do it great. Why not go into media? Why not go into manufacturing? Why not go into brand marketing? Why not go into agency? Why not go into music? There's no harm, no foul. And I think that is the epitome of the black sheep thinker, is to be like, why can't I do this? Why not? Why can't I break these barriers? And that's bode very well for me. It started when I said, why not go into the music industry? What do I have to lose? Absolutely nothing. And I have everything to gain. People look at my CV and they're just like, they don't know what to do with it, but it was all by design, because people love to put labels on you. And I never wanted to be defined by what I did. I wanted to just be known as an amazing businesswoman. And so hopefully I accomplished that by forging into different territories and proving so many people wrong.
So we're going to get into our lightning round of questions.
Amazing. Great.
I'm going to ask you a question. Let me know what pops into your mind.
I love it.
First question is East Coast or West Coast?
You know, they both have great qualities, but I have to say I'm an East Coaster.
Wow.
Wow.
Who is your favorite artist or musician you've recently listened to?
Oh, I'm obsessed with Celeste, this artist out of the UK. Soul singer, amazing, super young, was in Gucci ads. She's fabulous.
Favorite article of clothing?
Blue peacoat from Louis Vuitton. And it has these white big stripes. It's just fabulous. It kind of looks like something from the 60s. I'm obsessed with it.
What is a funny encounter that comes to mind with an artist?
God. Running through an airport with Redman and Method Man, about to miss our flight to Los Angeles. We were in DC and they decided they wanted Burger King. And I'm trying to drag them to the gate and they take off running in opposite directions. And there's me about to get arrested as I'm preventing the airplane doors from closing, because I was like, you got to wait a few minutes. You have to wait a few. And it's just utterly ridiculous. And I love them both to this day.
What are you most proud of?
Being the president of BBH New York.
We always ask this on every podcast episode. If you could leave our listeners with one lasting piece of advice, what would that be?
It's my life mantra, which goes, the longer I live, the more I realize the importance of attitude on life, by Charles Swindoll.
I love that. Wow. Well, Imani, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been amazing. I'll come back anytime.
please.
You're more than welcome to. Well, thank you again.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thanks so much for listening to an episode of Redefining Ambition. If you like what you heard, please make sure to subscribe, rate us, tell your friends, and if there's anyone you think we should have on our show, let me know. Join me next Tuesday for a brand new episode of Redefining Ambition. We'll see you all then. Take care, everyone.